Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Amazon's Ring cameras apparently have a deal with the police. Credit cards are tracking you too. The ridiculousness of tech patents. Apple announced its upcoming iPhone event. And we try to fire Barry. We end up giving him a promotion instead. That's up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 97, recorded Thursday, August 29th, 2019. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Monday.com. Monday.com helps teams manage work and meet deadlines while building a culture of transparency. Manage all your core business activities in one place. Learn more at Monday.com/TNW.
And by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's Advanced Technology Center is like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including OEMs like NetApp, and it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all that it offers, go to wwt.com/twit. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly. This, of course, is the show where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Micah Sargent.
And I'm Jason Howell. You ready to break some news?
Oh yeah, break it.
Although I don't know that we have like breaking news, but we break news every Thursday on Tech News Weekly.
That's why we're here.
Amazon's Ring doorbells are insanely popular. I actually have one outside of my home. Chances are many of you do too. So you've probably heard the news the past few months that show how these doorbell cameras have become a hot topic with police who would love access to the video footage that relates to crime. This kind of access seems to be happening behind the scenes already. There's already been little to no transparency about it, not from Ring or from the precincts that reportedly use the footage for their own investigative work. Alfred Ng is a reporter for CNET. And Alfred, you've been following this story pretty closely over the past few months. Welcome to the show. It's good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet. So first things first, what do we know for sure is happening right now behind the scenes of these doorbell cameras?
So we know that Ring has been trying to convince hundreds of police departments across the country. They've been telling them, look, these police departments around you are joining us. It helps solve some crimes, even though there's no proof that it drops the crime rates at all. They've done their own studies, but when it's put up to scrutiny, it doesn't really stand up to that test. And we know that, you know, the police have basically been kind of parroting what Ring wants them to say. So in some emails where police say, we have this new surveillance tool, Ring will email them and say, hey, we've made some edits to the press release that you're planning on putting out. Please don't use the term surveillance because that might raise some privacy concerns, even though that is, you know, essentially exactly what it is.
Okay, wow. So how transparent has this become? And was this out of just basic necessity for the fact that this was getting so much attention? Are they providing tools for people to know? Because, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people bought these cameras because they wanted personal security, mm-hmm. not necessarily knowing that it would become kind of part of this like larger web of surveillance.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you buy these cameras, you know that, you know, you have one, but, you know, police, when they partner with Ring, they know where everybody has one. And, you know, people don't know that. People don't, there's a heat map that they used to provide to police. They only recently got rid of it maybe like a week or so ago. But that map basically showed police, here are all the areas where Ring cameras are. And in an email to police, Ring had told officers details about this heat map should be kept from the public. The map that came out yesterday of, you know, 400 plus police departments that are partnered with Ring, that is the most transparent that Ring has gotten so far. And even then, that's not really saying that much. I mean, just the, you know, total number is not exactly extremely transparent. You know, I've been asking Ring for that number since May, and they only released it yesterday, I believe, after pressure from all this reporting from outlets like CNET, also Gizmodo and Motherboard, and the Washington Post article yesterday.
Yeah, right. Now, had any of this, like, I guess where I'm headed is terms of service, privacy policy, These are things that, you know, we see flash across our faces on all the products that we use. And let's be honest, most people don't read them. Mm-hmm. Are there any signals that we know of that were actually put out by Ring to allude to this, you know, albeit, you know, even loosely worded, but something that specified that this might actually be happening behind the scenes prior to this news becoming so big?
Well, not really. No, not in the privacy policy. I mean, the privacy policy is standard stuff that you would see that, you know, Facebook would have in its own privacy policy or Twitter, where, you know, we reserve the rights to use these images. You know, we can use this for data advertising, things like that, but nothing about law enforcement involvement. And, you know, Ring will say that they've been transparent about it, but, you know, this is something that they've been talking to police about since March last year. And they only put a blog post about why they partner with police about it on August 22nd. So it's been more than a year that these partnerships have been starting off. And it's only until, you know, the press really started taking a closer look at it that they've decided to give all this information out.
Yeah. It's always fun when it comes down to that. If someone happens to own one of these cameras, do they have no choice? It's just if you live in one of the precincts where this is kind of part of the bigger web of surveillance, like you have no choice, or can people actually opt out of it?
So that's one of the small caveats of it. And Ring, if you look on their social media feed, they have been spamming the same copy and paste post to everybody complaining about these police partnerships, saying that people have consent to share this footage with police or not. So the way that it works is if I'm an officer and I'm requesting for footage within a certain like block or neighborhood, they can geofence it and then request for footage for that area. And everyone that has a Ring camera in that area would get a ping on their phone saying, hello, you know, officer from this department is looking for video from 8 o'clock today to 6 o'clock today. It would help with their investigation if you send it over. They can say no, and they don't have to send that over. But what I've seen in my reporting, if that doesn't work out for them, they will canvass that neighborhood, you know, on foot and look at the doorbell specifically. And if they see mm-hmm. that it's a Ring doorbell, they'll go up and then ask for it in person, which is a much different approach than, you know, asking from the phone app itself.
So I do want to double down on that and be super clear here. This is an opt-in every time functionality. So I get a push notification on my phone that says, would you like to help with this report? And here is how, or this investigation. And here is how, or like you said, the police will in some cases come to your door and ask you for it. It is not, I just want to make that clear. It's not as if the footage is just automatically being piped to police as it currently stands, correct?
Yeah. Okay. That is the current process. Yes. But police are also able to subpoena that. There's a subpoena email from Ring, and they can get something signed off from a judge and get the videos that way. And when that happens, they get footage from people's Ring cameras without them even knowing, because Amazon or Ring will provide that directly to them if they have a warrant, of course.
Yeah, I think one thing that strikes me as interesting and a little odd in this is that it really sounds like Ring has a good amount of sway here. Obviously, they created the technology, but, you know, we've been reading reports, yours included, talking about how Ring is essentially telling police, this is information that you can share with people. This is information that you shouldn't. Why, in this case, why is Ring kind of holding the cards, as it were?
Well, yeah, they offer these tools for free to local police departments. And, you know, it gives police something that they've almost never had before in the past. I mean, think about where surveillance cameras are in neighborhoods. You know, they're around businesses, they're around like city areas. They're most of the times they're not around residential neighborhoods. And that's, you know, a lot of crimes can happen in you know, in someone's home, and they never really have cameras for it. So by partnering with Ring, they get access to basically something that they've never had before, which is cameras on almost every home. And to do that, you know, they have to abide by these contracts, which will say, you know, this is what you can and cannot post on social media about our products.
Yeah, this is really interesting. Who actually approached who first here? Do we have any indication as far as that's concerned? Was this Ring saying, hey, we want to make this deal with you? Or was it police saying, hey, that's actually really valuable, what can we do to gain access?
So it varies by different police departments. When I saw in Chula Vista, California, Ring had reached out to their police departments on a cold call, and they reached out basically saying, they reached out with an email that first started by saying, hi, we've noticed an uptick in crime in your neighborhood. Would you be interested in a free like Ring camera? They didn't respond for about 10 days or so. And then they follow up with saying, hey, you know, just following up, but also here's a $50 discount for your entire police department if you are interested in our product. That got their foot in the door. So in that case, Ring reached out first. So in another example, Ring often goes to police conferences. They go to the International Association of Chief of Police Conference every year. One of their executives is actually on a board there, and they'll set up a booth there with all these other cops there. And, you know, police will stop by and see the technology there and think, oh, this is pretty useful. How do I get in touch? And then I'll see FOIA emails where they're following up on that saying, hey, we met at this conference. We're definitely interested in learning about your product. Can you send us a copy? And how do we, you know, sign up for this?
Yeah. Well, you're doing some great work covering this. You've been, like I said earlier, following this for the last couple of months as it's developed. So you've got a lot of articles that you've written for CNET. Everybody should definitely check out Alfred's work, CNET.com. Where can people follow you online?
You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Alfred WKNG. And as always, you can follow me on CNET.com as well.
Right on, Alfred. Appreciate you taking the time. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to you soon. All right, coming up, the privacy path left behind your use of that boring old credit card that you have. You may not have thought that there's anything to worry about there. You may be wrong. We'll talk about that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Monday.com. Monday.com not only helps teams manage work and meet deadlines, but also builds a culture of transparency to work better together, so you can manage all your core business activities in one place. Things from high-level roadmaps to specific day-to-day tasks and everything in between. Join over 65,000 teams already getting things done with Monday.com. Monday.com is easy to use. You just build a board from scratch, or you can choose from a selection of templates and then kind of tweak that, tailor it to your team's workflow. That's kind of the beauty of the templates, a starting point, and you can go from there and let your imagination kind of run wild for your team. Automate your workflows with reminders and notifications. You can upload files directly from your computer or from the cloud, like Dropbox, Google Drive. Monday.com is perfect for any team. It's suitable for any size. If you happen to be, you know, have two freelancers working together, it's going to work, or thousands collaborating across the globe. Monday.com is perfect for that as well. Popular among teams, often replacing burdensome Excel files, whiteboards, excessively long meetings, Monday.com keeps you on track and creates accountability because it assigns owners to keep track of who's doing what, which is really nice to have. And you won't miss a deadline with My Week. That's the personal assistant for you and your team. You can stay in control anywhere you happen to be. Of course, Monday.com has a mobile app. And we're kind of integrating it here as well. Micah, you started using Monday.com with Leo to put together the show doc for iOS today, right?
Yeah, that is correct.
Started that recently. How's that going?
So it's going really well. The good thing about Monday is, along with sort of all of the options that are available for setting up your table, as it were, There are a lot of individual options that you can tie into it. So you can set up due dates, you can have checkboxes. There's like even this little temperature option that shows like how far along things have come. And so see if things are kind of cooling down, or if you have a lot that's getting finished. So there are lots of different integrations that make it simple, but it's nice, you know, depending on the episode, making sure we've got everything locked in place. We know what the topic is. We know if we're going to have a guest, we know this, that, or the other. It makes it super simple to go in and see that really quickly. And it's that transparency that I think is very important that they talk about here, that depending on who you invite to your team, everybody can kind of see what everybody's doing. And you know, if you want to reach out and help somebody with something that they might be stuck on, or if they've got it done. So yeah. I really like that ability that Monday offers that you sometimes don't get with other things, where it's sort of an individual task versus everybody being able to see what's going on.
Sure, a lot more expandable than just a lowly Google Doc as well. So you can learn more and start your 14-day free trial. Just go to monday.com/TNW. That's monday.com/TNW for your free 2-week trial. Check it out for yourself and see what you think. And we thank monday.com for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right, we're so used to hearing the same story about our privacy, and it usually involves well, that phone that sits inside our pockets and purses. But there's something else sharing space with those phones that might have its own privacy problem. Jeffrey Fowler writes for The Washington Post and joins us now to talk about the privacy footprint left behind when we use our credit cards, something I think we all probably take lightly, right? Like, we're so used to using credit cards. Welcome back to the show, Jeffrey.
Thanks for having me.
It's awesome to get you back on. Always love getting you on. So it's easy to think of credit cards as old technology, if one would even call them technology to begin with. You decided to track what happens when you purchase a lowly banana with your cards, which, first of all, I love that you started off with a banana, because we happen to have a banana. They're really easy to come by. You bought yours with a credit card, which was like 60 some odd cents. So props to you. What cards did you compare against each other to begin with, and why those in particular?
Yeah, so it was two bananas, in fact.
That's right.
At the Target here in San Francisco. And then each one I purchased with a different credit card. So the first one was the Amazon Visa Prime Rewards card from Chase. And the other is the new Apple card. And the reason I chose that one is because Apple is selling it as being better at privacy in many ways. And I wanted to see if it really was.
Yeah. So I'm sure going into something like this, you had some expectations on what you were going to find. You know, we've heard about the Apple card and the privacy kind of aspects tied in with that. And then we've got our credit card that we take for granted. Like, when you started down this road, what did you kind of find out about these? Like, did you, reading the fine print, did that give you an indication as far as what to expect? And would you say what you got actually kind of rang true with what you read?
I found that my data, in different ways with each card, went to a lot of different places. It went to Amazon. It went to Google. It went to hedge funds. You kind of name it, it went to that organization. And I found that credit card companies and the banks behind them and retailers that are also tapping into this data are really bad about answering questions about this. They're trying to get them to be specific and transparent about what data they were collecting and who they were sharing it with and how they were mining it was really hard. And I think it really shows how the gulf we have in transparency about data that we've just been sort of beginning to explore with big tech companies like Facebook, really we're going to have big problems when it comes to all the other companies in our life that also collect data.
Yeah.
So I do want to ask you about that. You said it was difficult for them to get specific about the data. Do you think this is trouble getting specific because they themselves are not necessarily aware of how that data is being used, or because they don't want to talk about it?
That's a good question. I think it may be somewhere in between. I think, first of all, they're just not accustomed to customers or journalists asking specific questions. And in other cases, they probably set up systems where they've tied themselves into contracts where they may not be allowed to talk about it. Let's take, for example, that Amazon Prime Chase Visa Rewards card that I use. That's a really common card. You see lots of people who have it. Now, when you use that, you might assume that Chase, your bank, is going to get some data, and it has to process the transaction. But what was surprising to me is, by law, how many other companies and organizations Chase is allowed to share that data with. All it has to do is send you a notification at least once a year, a little piece of paper in the mail that you probably immediately threw away that says facts at the top of it. And then there's like a long list of seven different kinds of organizations that it might share your data with. I went through those, and the most curious of them to me was the last one on the list. It says, with non-affiliates for the purposes of marketing. Now, I said, what's a non-affiliate? And it turns out it's anyone. Ugh. It's any company not owned by Chase that they want to share data with. And that could include, for example, Amazon. So I went to Chase, and I said, okay, you're co-branding this card with Amazon. What data do you share with Amazon? You know, what specifically do they learn about all my purchases not on Amazon when I'm at Target or I'm at grocery store? They would not tell me. You know, even though we went around and around, they told me lots of things that they do not share, but they would never get specific about what they do share. And I think that just speaks to a really big problem we have here. How are we supposed to trust and make decisions about, you know, who we want to do our business with as credit cards go, or as retailers go, if they won't even tell us what they're doing with this data?
Yeah. And that data is just passing passing between hands, between places. We don't know what it is. Is there any indication that sometimes this data is actually anonymized, or are we to just assume that because it's tied to our purchases, it's probably tied to our name, and the chance of that being anonymized, well, probably not little.
Well, a really good question. And so I should preface it by saying, of course, there are lots of really important conversations that particularly academics are having right now about whether any data can ever truly be anonymized.
Totally.
Because there's always ways to reattribute things. And of course, there's a big industry that tries to do that with our data all the time. That said, some of the players who grab data from my credit card when I made that transaction expressly say they do so in an aggregated kind of way. And that includes Visa and MasterCard. So those are the card networks that your card runs on, even if you have an Apple card that's supposed to be better at privacy. That's running through MasterCard. And it turns out MasterCard has a side business where it sells what it calls data insights that are aggregated and anonymized in certain ways to lots of different kinds of companies. Those companies include Google, with whom MasterCard apparently has a deal to help link up purchases we make in the real world with ads we might have seen on Google properties. This is called attribution, and it helps Google get paid more for its ads. Neither company would sort of own up to the program. We first learned about it because of some good reporting by Bloomberg. I found someone who confirmed it to me. Still, after all of that, MasterCard and Google would not acknowledge that they have such a deal. So again, a big trust problem here. If they're just not even going to be honest that they're working together, how are we supposed to trust them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then we have Apple, of course, you know, 50% of your reporting here happens to deal directly with the Apple Card. Apple Card kind of hangs its hat, at least partially, on this kind of commitment to privacy and not data sharing and all this kind of stuff. Do you think that commitment rings true based on what you've seen? Or is that kind of like, oh, yeah, it does over here, but over here, not so much?
Look, I think the Apple Card provides an important new alternative for consumers where we can make a choice for a card that is better about our privacy. That said, it doesn't go as far as I hoped it would. So let me first explain what it does well. So I mentioned that we get these letters in the mail from our bank once a year that says all of the companies that they can share our data with. If you get an Apple Card, when you get that letter from Goldman Sachs, the bank that backs the Apple Card, it's going to say that actually they will not share the data with non-affiliates for marketing. And Apple built this into its contracts with Goldman. And that's a good thing. We should have banks trying to compete based on not passing our data around. And that might cause some people to choose the Apple Card, even though maybe its rewards aren't as good as some of the other options out there. So that is in the plus side for the Apple Card. The minus side for the Apple Card is that it didn't seem to introduce any new technology that might sort of keep all of the other hands that are trying to grab at our data from doing so. And by that, I mean MasterCard. It runs on the MasterCard network. But as far as I could piece together, every time you swipe an Apple Card, your transaction is still ending up helping Google. And if you want to get out of that, you have to go to a special spot on the MasterCard website and opt out. It also doesn't do anything to keep retailers from using your credit card to track you. For example, I had thought that if I used Apple Pay, or particularly Apple Pay with an Apple Card, to pay for something like, let's say, a coffee at Blue Bottle in San Francisco, that I would be anonymous every time I paid for it. But in fact, no. The Apple Card still presents a number that can be tagged and used to identify me across different purchases. That's why when I go to Blue Bottle, it already knows my phone number to send me a receipt. And again, Apple could have innovated a little bit more here with technology. They could have found some ways to maybe generate whole new numbers every time you have to you pay with Apple Pay, but it didn't do that. And that's a little bit of a disappointment to me.
Another aspect that you brought up in your piece that kind of got my attention were apps like Mint, these apps that, you know, pull in financial data, you know, and we opt in, of course. We're joining that service, and so we want the app or the service to kind of organize our payments and, you know, label them and do all this stuff that because we don't want to have to do it. Mint is, of course, just one example. But should we be concerned with apps like these that are able to get at this information? It's kind of like we're receiving some benefit from the data that's being shared, but what are the downsides there?
Yeah, I think that's an important kind of decision that a lot of people have to make and we have to really consider. I think the bigger problem is that people forget that the reason why a lot of these financial services are free is because they want your data. And Mint is a good example of that. Sure. They want to use your data to market back to you on the Mint website and app. They're a little bit like Facebook in that, and that they don't sell your data to other people, but then they use it to target you with advertising. Same thing goes for Credit Karma. And I think the question I have is, are people really aware of the trade-off that they're making there with their data? And then there's even other services that people really don't think about what they're handing out. One of those is like Gmail. So anytime you receive a receipt for some purchase in your inbox from Gmail, Google puts it into a special database of all your purchases. I have a link to it in my piece. You can look at it. It's a pretty creepy list of purchases. And I'm like, Google, why are you doing this? And they say, okay, for now, you know, they won't target ads based on it, but this is Google. And so how much should we trust that they're really going to respect that in a way going forward? And also, there's no way to stop it. The only way to take a purchase out of Google's database of all your purchases is to go and delete that email.
Yeah, so I found that kind of unsettling as well, so much so that when it knew that I was going to a movie theater, it knew which seat I was sitting in and what movie I was seeing using that receipt that it got via my email.
Wow.
That was not fun for me to know that that was happening. Now, you said, you know, this is something that you're concerned about in terms of, do people know about this? What do we do about people not knowing about this? It's writing articles like this. I mean, do you feel like the everyday person is aware? And if not, then what are we going to do about it?
Right. I think a lot of these tech companies would say, oh, but we give people control, right? When Mark Zuckerberg was in front of Congress, he said, we give people control over their data something like 45 different times because I was counting. I don't think that adds up here. Just giving people a way to opt out of something that you're automatically going to have them do is not really control. The devil is in the defaults. And all the defaults and all the situations we've been talking about here today involve taking people's data and using it. And you have to kind of very aggressively go and opt out of these things. And if you're the kind of person that cares a lot, you'll do that. And I've got some links in my column in the post to help you do that with credit cards and others. But I don't really think ultimately that is the solution. I think we need two things to happen. One, we might need some laws. I mean, this is where the government is supposed to step in and really help us. We do have privacy laws in the U.S. about sort of niche kind of vertical topics like health data. But it turns out the ones for our financial data aren't really that good. There is that credit card law that I mentioned, but all it requires is disclosure. It doesn't really say what the default activity should be. So there's definitely a big conversation to be had about that. And then I think also companies need to learn that this is how they're going to be judged now, and not just based on privacy, but just based on disclosure. Are they able and willing to answer our questions and be clear about what they're doing with our data? I think there's a new generation of consumers who are going to take that to be something important that they use to evaluate a company as much as maybe people, you know, 20 years or 30 years ago might have talked about privacy. So I think we have power as consumers, and we just need to start demanding that companies compete on this stuff.
Absolutely agree. Jeffrey Fowler, always appreciate you taking the time. It's so great to get you on. Excellent piece. People can find it at the Washington Post. That's WashingtonPost.com. Where can people follow you online?
You can follow me on Twitter at Jeffrey Fowler. That's Jeffrey with a G, like the giraffe, who is kind of out of a job at Toys R Us right now.
Yeah. Not hearing much from that Jeffrey anymore.
Yeah.
Sad day. Well, he's retired.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's okay. All right. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon. Appreciate you.
You bet. Take care.
Bye.
All right, coming up, we take a look at the wild and wacky world of tech patents. But first,
Were you about to eat that banana?
I was thinking about it.
Okay, yeah. All right.
I didn't buy it with a credit card, though, so it's fine.
All right.
We are going to take a look at the wild and wacky world of tech patents. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. WWT began building their Advanced Technology Center, ATC, 10 years ago, and it has grown exponentially. It's like no other testing and research lab. The lab contains more than $500 million in equipment from hundreds of OEMs and key partners, ranging from heavyweights like NetApp, Cisco, and VMware to emerging disruptors like Tanium, Equinix, and Expanse. WWT is a trusted partner who stays with you over the years. Many of their customers have been with them for over a decade because they know WWT is where they can go to get the answers they need to make sure their business runs right. Their ATC is an incubator for IT innovation and offers on-demand and schedulable labs like NetApp Cloud Volumes on Tap, OnTap on Flash, NetApp Disaster Recovery as a Service, along with hundreds of other labs representing newest advances in flash storage, multi-cloud, hyper-converged infrastructure, cloud data management, and more. Learn about products before you launch. WWT's engineers use these environments to quickly spin up proofs of concept and pilots using the sandbox so customers can confidently select the best solutions. In many cases, this reduces concept time from months to weeks, which increases speed to market. They offer Lab as a Service, a dedicated lab space within the ATC. Here, customers can perform programmatic testing using the vast technology ecosystem that WWT has already built. It's virtual, so you can take full advantage of ATC's unique benefits anywhere in the world 24/7. WWT engineers work in these labs every day, beta testing new equipment and building reference architectures and custom integrations to help their customers make decisions and see results faster and with much less investment. The time is finally here. WWT has launched their new digital platform encompassing the ATC ecosystem. This ecosystem creates a multiplier effect of knowledge, speed, and agility anytime, anywhere around the world for their customers. Get access to articles, case studies, hands-on labs, and other tools that make the difference in today's fast-paced world. To learn more about WWT, the ATC, and to sign up for access to their new on-demand lab platform, go to wwt.com/twit. WWT simplifies the complex. That's wwt.com/twit. WWT, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. Now, if you've spent any time looking at tech news, you've certainly come across a headline or two that claims a tech company is working on bizarre, futuristic, or seemingly impossible products. But if you take the time to view the article, you discover their source, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Tech patents make for great headlines, sure, but Rose Eveleth of Slate is here to give us a little more information about these black and white and diagrammed all over documents. Hello, Rose.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I want to kick things off. You wrote, "Understanding patents offers a window not just into the labyrinthine world of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and its potential failings, but also into how companies think about the future." So let's start there. Can you explain why patents are sort of a glimpse into a company's psyche?
Sure. So, you know, companies file patents for things even if they're not sure they're going to use them. Patents get filed really early in the process just in case. And so often they aren't necessarily a reflection of what the company is making day to day, but instead sort of the problems that they're thinking about and some of the solutions they might be considering using to solve those problems. And so it's really more, I think, a glimpse into kind of like, what are the big questions that they're coming to their engineers and saying, like, we got to figure this out. Let's brainstorm. Let's figure out what to do. And so you see these patents, and some of them seem kind of weird. Some of them seem kind of funny. People love to make fun of patents. Like you said, there's so many articles, and it's sort of a pet peeve of mine where like tech reporters will be like, Facebook is doing this thing. And if you look at it, Facebook's not actually doing that thing. They simply filed a patent that like maybe kind of talks about that thing. But it is a good way to kind of see what Facebook is worrying about or what Amazon is worrying about or Sony or whatever company you want to look at.
Yeah. So going on with that, you know, we talk a lot about media literacy as a whole and how important that is. And I was hoping, you know, one of the things you mentioned is that claims are the most important part of a patent. So for the listeners out there, and for me as well, could you give us some tips on sort of patent literacy? What should we be looking for if we want to go past the headline and understand how to sort of break apart a patent?
Sure. I should caveat this by saying that I'm not a lawyer. So if you have real like patent law questions, you should absolutely consult a lawyer. But, you know, I think that the thing that people love to jump on top of with patents is the pictures. And I, too, they're great. They're delightful. But the pictures don't really matter that much in terms of what the patent is actually saying. The thing that matters is the claims. And the claims are the thing that the patent is saying, you know, this is the thing that's original. This is the thing that doesn't exist in the world. And that I am kind of like you know, giving to the U.S. Patent Office in order to be to get protection back, right? So the big sort of the whole deal with patents is that you tell the world how this great invention that you've come up with works, and you share that information with the United States, with the world, and that's great for everybody. And then the U.S. in return gives you protection on that patent for 20 years of the term, assuming you maintain the patent through its life. And so, you know, that is the claims are what you are saying, like, this is the actual invention. This is the actual thing that I have come up with. Everything else is kind of trappings to that. And they can be important. And, you know, the other things that are in the patent are useful information. But if you really want to know what a patent is about and what they are actually kind of saying that they have invented, the claims are the thing that you want to read. Now, like any technical document, there are pieces of jargon and there are weird ins and outs of claims. You know, in the piece for Slate, I talked a little bit about prophetic examples.
Yes.
So you can actually sort of make things up in a patent that you don't have to necessarily have done the experiments. You can just say, like, this experiment shows blank thing, that this totally works, the thing that I've invented, and that can be untrue. So there are weird things about patents, and it's not your fault if you get confused reading a patent, if you're just like a regular person like you or me. But if you do really want to kind of dive in, if you see a tech headline or you read something and you're like, that sounds weird, the place to go is the claims.
So what kind of struck me in reading through the piece, I thought it was fascinating because, I mean, so many, you know, on the shows that I do here, that we do here, that I'm definitely totally guilty of, like, oh my goodness, they're working on that patent, because it's just so easy to get entranced by it, mm-hmm. because they're usually very creative and often they are very different from what we're used to seeing, or maybe they're an extension of what we're used to seeing almost to like a ridiculous point. And so it's very easy to want to get excited about that. But if they so easily stifle innovation, like if they are truly just, you know, we run a company and we want to file all these patents to make sure that the other people don't do these things, we have no intention of doing them, it just seems like so much of the innovation around these ideas ends up just kind of falling flat because they're using it as weapons instead of using them as real ideas to become something someday. What do you think about that? Like, is that unfair? I mean, it feels unfair to me that no one would be able to tap into that.
I think, this is a huge debate among like the patent world and especially the tech patent world. And in different realms, I think the answer is slightly different, right? So you have technology patents, you have software patents, you have things like pharmaceutical patents and biotechnology patents, and it's a little bit different in each place. I think that, you know, in theory, that it's not necessarily fair to say to a company, you can only patent things that you know you're going to use. Because most companies are patenting things long before they might wind up using them. And that's fine. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that because like anything, you know, you have a big problem to solve, right? Let's say you're Amazon and you really need to figure out like, how do we get all the stuff that we have to all the people who want it, right? That's a huge logistical supply chain problem. And there are going to be a ton of possible solutions here. And which solution is the right one kind of depends on what happens with lots of other things that you maybe don't have control over, like infrastructure and the economy and all of that stuff. So it makes sense to maybe go after a couple of different solutions that might be the one that you want to use. And I don't think it necessarily makes sense to say like, no, you can't do that. You can only patent something when you have officially decided that you want to use it. Because that kind of, you know, defeats the purpose, especially even for like a small, let's say you're not Amazon. Let's say you're just you or me and you come up with a genius invention. You know, if you don't have the funds or the resources necessarily to prove that it works yet, but you know in your heart of hearts that it will, I don't think that it necessarily makes sense for the patent office, for the government to say like, no, you can't use it. You cannot patent that. That said, obviously, you know, there's the flip side, right? There are what people call patent trolls. There are people who weaponize sort of these sort of intellectual property documents and go after people for infringing on patents that maybe are too broad or maybe shouldn't have been, you know, implemented in the first place. So it is a balancing act. And I think it's really hard, right? Because the whole premise of the patent office is to protect inventors, right? To say like, you know, in the old school kind of like, you know, American way of like, you're in your garage and you've invented something and we're going to protect you and we're going to protect that invention. And that's important. And I think that's really great. The question then becomes like, how do we make sure that that piece of it is protected without kind of like getting overzealous and telling people they can't do certain things? It's really hard to balance those two things. I am glad that I don't have to make policy around this.
Yeah, no kidding.
Speaking of balancing those two things, something I found fascinating in your piece is that some companies choose not to file patents for the things that they are most focused on. Can you talk a little bit about why a company would be motivated to refrain from filing a patent?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously a patent is public, right? Anybody, you, me, any person with an internet connection or even with just like, you know, a letter in the mail can request information from the patent office and can, in theory, see how that thing works. Now, there are ways that companies can file patents and also still kind of protect what they're up to, right? So pharmaceutical patents are kind of a good example of this. Pharmaceutical companies will sometimes patent a bunch of formulas for a drug, and they know that only one of them actually works. But this is kind of a way to like obfuscate a little bit what they're doing while also getting the benefit of a patent. But other places, other companies, every company has a different strategy. And almost every giant tech company or really any company at all is going to have some kind of industry secret or trade secret that they protect, right? You know, the classic example of this is like food formulas, right? Like, what is it that makes a Dorito is like an industry secret and they're not going to patent that. And so it is kind of, you have to decide as a company, and every company has a different strategy, which pieces of your invention and innovation you want protection from for the patent office, and you want to maybe make sure that another company isn't doing, and which are important enough and sort of internal enough and secret enough that you don't necessarily want to share that with the world. So I think every company finds a balance in a different place on that, but almost every company that you have heard of that you use day to day, there are things that they do internally and processes and inventions and things that they do not patent because they don't necessarily want to tell people what they're up to.
Yeah, I think it was Elon Musk who said something along the lines of, we don't want to have a cookbook available for anybody to sort of go in and say, okay, this is how I make a SpaceX this or a SpaceX that, with diagrams, as we've talked about, and everything laid out. Although those diagrams, as you've said, are not that important, because sometimes you have a person standing up in front of a couch and shouting McDonald's. I want to talk about, one would think that the person that invents a thing is the person who's putting together the patent, but that's pretty much hardly ever true. It's the lawyer's job, and they get to be kind of, they're given the room to explore the space, as it were. Can you talk a little bit about that? I know you mentioned prophetic examples, but I think it's really important to drive home the fact that you can pretty much lie in a patent about what might happen because of it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously some patents, they are filed by the inventor, maybe with the help of a lawyer, maybe not, you know, but when we're talking about patents that this piece is about, which is the patents from big tech companies like, you know, Amazon, Facebook, Sony, there are whole teams, there are whole patent law teams that they work with. And in that case, a lot of the time what happens is these inventors, the engineers, whoever it is within the company meets with the patent lawyer, they talk about what that patent is about, they kind of give all the information that they can. Often they do give sketches and diagrams and things they've drawn up. And then it's really the patent lawyer's job to basically go out, take that information that they've collected and turn that into a patent. And what that means basically is taking this idea and imagining every possible way that the company might be able to use it. Because you want to make sure, if you're going to protect this idea, you want to make sure you're protecting every possible version of it. And, you know, patents are expensive to file. And so you want to really get the bang for your buck. And what that means is that, you know, like I mentioned, a patent, you can patent something that does not work and that you have no proof that works. You can patent something that is just an idea, right? There's, I think, one of the patents that I mentioned in the piece is a patent for a cancer cure, which I'm going to go out on a limb and say it doesn't work. But, you know, it doesn't have to be proven, right? You can patent anything that you have a sort of reasonable idea or sort of like a thought about. And the patent office has to decide whether that's reasonable, and there's sorts of like ins and outs there. And there's a long conversation to be had about like the expertise of patent officers, which is a whole other question. But so if you're the lawyer and you then are taken, you're given this task and you go off and you make the patent, you draw the diagrams. There's a whole job that somebody does where their job is to just be a patent drawer, like a person who draws the illustrations for patents. I had no idea that was a job you could have. So, you know, my high school guidance counselor did not tell me that one. and that's like a fun job, I think. But yeah, so like the lawyer is the one that kind of comes up with so many of the uses and so many of the examples. And it is kind of like writing science fiction. And the patent lawyers that I've talked to say it's really fun. And I believe them. It sounds so fun.
Yeah. So assuming that you don't go off and become a patent artist, I do want to thank you so much for joining us today, Rose. That was this whole article. Everybody should go read it. It was an incredible glimpse into everything to do with patents and sort of, like I said, a primer on what we need to know about about patents. It's important. So where can people follow you online and hopefully one day see your patent diagrams?
Yes, my second career as a patent illustrator. I host a podcast called Flash Forward, which you can find on any podcasting app. You can also find me on Twitter. I'm Rose Eveleth on pretty much every social platform. For better or for worse, I'm the only Rose Eveleth in the world. So if you Google that, that's me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rose.
Thanks for having me.
We'll talk to you
soon. Thanks for having me. This is fun.
All right. And we got a couple of stories to talk about. Story of the week. First of all, you can do a whole heck of a lot of things in VR. You can swing lightsabers. You can play golf. Maybe enjoy a vacation. Got a vacation simulator. It's a lot of fun. You can also fire somebody. Apparently, the company called Tailspin, which began in 2015, which I would say are the salad days of the resurgence of the idea of VR. Everything was super rosy way back then. Tailspin, I guess, has evolved since its creation in 2015 and found a niche not in the gaming industry, but in creating VR experiences that can simulate aspects of work that can be very challenging. And namely, one of the most challenging things, I think, if you run a business, could be canning that person and all the mental gymnastics that go into what can be a very awkward experience. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had to fire somebody? Let
Once.
Somebody go?
Yeah. And no, it's
it
not
sucks.
Fun. It wasn't in VR. It was in real, it was IRL, and I didn't enjoy it.
It sucks. It's no fun. And so basically, this experience is all about like increasing confidence, you know, possibly building up the bosses of the world, I suppose, to be able to fire people and not feel badly about it, or maybe they feel badly about it, but still maneuver through it.
To be able to professionally fire someone.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. Beware of the things that could get you into trouble. They point out in the article saying something like, you have a ton of experience and plenty of time left to make your mark. And how that might translate into ageism of some sort. Yeah, that sort of stuff.
There's still plenty of time in your life.
Yes.
You're not going to die.
This is not the end of your life. You still got at least 15 years. Okay?
You got 15 years on you. You kicked the tires recently. I think there's 15 years left.
So, I've heard of VR being used empathy, mm-hmm. you know, being used to like place
absolutely.
Yourself into a situation where you can empathize with a person, or, you know, it's not all about fun and games.
Yeah.
Sometimes it really is about connecting to a piece of you or an experiential thing that is just next to impossible to get that experience through just reading it or through words or whatever. Actually placing yourself in the situation can go a long way. So, I don't know. This is interesting. It also kind of feels a little cold. You know what I mean?
I could see, because I was going to say on the other side of that, there are VR experiences for people who are learning how to figure out their job if they're like working in mechanical situations.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Because, you know, in order for those mechanical situations to take place, something has to be broken and things aren't always broken. And so if you've got 15 people that you've hired to fix those things, then it is kind of nice to have that VR experience of being able to fix a forklift tire or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And I could see how that's helpful versus just like reading a document that tells you and has patent diagrams in it.
Yes, right. Really totally.
But yeah, this is, I mean, it involves a real person. And so I don't know. I would love to actually get to experience this just to see and how it differs or is the same, because people are unpredictable as kind of a just base understanding of humans.
Yep.
And so I don't think that, you know, the person on the other side of the VR experience, what's the character's name in this?
Oh boy, what was his name? I did not write that down. Is it Barry? Yeah, it's Barry.
Yeah, so I don't think that Barry is going to chuck his chair at you. But Barry. Yeah. You never know. Look at those eyes. Barry has some eyes that you just can't say no to.
I feel like he's
to.
Staring into my soul
Please,
right now.
Please don't let me go.
Oh my God. This story kind of makes me sad.
Yeah.
Stop looking at me, Barry.
Barry.
Your eyes are getting bigger.
See,
stop
so
it.
We would fail is yes. the thing. We would not pass the
Barry,
first
you know what?
Experience.
I've changed my mind. I'm giving you a raise.
Yeah.
You are going to be the president
You're
of this
take
company.
My job.
Barry, could you fire me?
How would you like to be fired, Barry?
So anyways, I would be very curious to check this out.
I would also be very curious to check this out.
Dang it. Why didn't I see that one? I'm the dad here.
There's a VR pun experience that we need to be checking out, surely. Right.
Second only to bananas in the show.
Yes, by the absolutely.
Way. All right. What you got?
So Apple invites have gone out. We now know for sure that the media event is on September 10th. And speaking of puns, the event invite says by innovation only as opposed to invitation only. So we know that there's going to be an event. And some of the things that we're looking at include a new Apple Watch, although the Apple Watch doesn't really need much of an update. So rumors and suggestions point to, instead of much of an internal update, we're looking at two new options for materials.
Oh, okay.
So they kind of got rid of the ceramic model for a while. The ceramic model might be coming back, and then they're also going
what
to
about
have
gold.
No gold, thank God. Can we just pretend that never existed? Let's just toss that one out of there. That's why Barry got fired, because Barry came up with gold.
Barry, yeah. You're the one.
Sorry, Barry. As well as a titanium model, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Apple TV and HomePod likely are going to stay the same, but there have been some rumors about AirPods with some like waterproofing, sweatproof, kind of more meant for workouts. So that's interesting to some people, as well as, of course, this is the event where Apple announces their phones. This the September event is the iPhone announcement event.
Yeah.
So we're looking at, of course, a newer chip, better cameras, possibly a phone called the iPhone 11 Pro.
Okay.
They're gonna throw in a Pro potentially, and we're looking at a 6.1 inch screen and a 5.8 and 6.5 inch screen with three cameras on the back.
On the like
two.
Box,
yeah,
camera
it's like a
array.
Weird little array, yeah.
Weird, but yet, I mean, we're gonna be seeing more of this. We already did actually. Mm-hmm. I believe there was a Huawei phone. I think it was Huawei that had. I can't remember the model off the top of my head that had the square form factor for the camera array. Apple, of course, is almost certainly going to have it on their new iPhones.
It's like the face. It's like,
yes. Ooh. And the Pixel 4 is going to have the box camera array. So weird now, but in a year, it's going to be normal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just like most things tend to be. At one point, it was strange to have AirPods in your ears, but now I see them everywhere.
Yeah, I see that. I still feel like they look a little strange. I'm not an AirPod owner or user, so I haven't like gotten adjusted to them in my own ears. So they still look weird to me, but...
You know, it is what it is.
But I find it interesting that they would get updated for the gym, because, I mean, I feel like I see people working out with AirPods all the
already.
Time.
Already, yeah. And I think, you know, in fact, I'm going to be taking in my AirPods this weekend because one of them completely makes no sound now.
Oh,
please don't send me tweets where you're telling me that I need to suck on the AirPod. I've already heard that, and there's no way in any world.
Don't do that.
There's no universe in which Micah with a goatee or Micah without a goatee, that's like alternate universe Micah. No one's sucking on an AirPod, thank you. So anyway, I'm going to be taking those in.
Don't do that.
And I'd like to believe that an improvement to the AirPods includes, if it's wax or if it's sweat or if it's whatever,
okay,
improvements to that so that I don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, yeah. I do worry about the use of innovation in the invite.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a company called OnePlus proclaim itself the flagship killer, and that haunted it for years.
Mm-hmm.
Even though their phones were really good, when you make a claim like that,
you
better back it up. Do you think from what you've seen about the new products, you know, from leaks and that sort of stuff, that the claim of innovation could be applied here, or does this feel like an incremental?
Well, Jason, I tried to take my jaded pill this morning.
Okay.
And so I'm going through a cleanse right now of not being jaded. What I would say is that the next phones are not going to be that impressive to me, and I wouldn't call it innovation.
Okay.
But for the average person who is not jaded or isn't going through their jaded cleanse, maybe.
Sure.
But
okay.
I don't know, at the end of the day, adding another camera and putting in a new chip is just par for the course.
Kind of par for the course.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, the majority of people who have, you know, have bought iPhones already or who will buy them will not even know anything about like the invite of this event.
Right. That's true.
Apple saying anything about innovation in the invite will matter zero to them because they will never know that. They'll just go into the store and see the next iPhone and go, I want that one.
That's the one that I'd like to get, please.
Oh, that's the new one? Great. That's the one I want.
Yes. And those are the people we have to remember and not us who are like, oh, it's going to have an OLED screen and kind of look like this one. Well, that's nothing new.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's innovative or not. If people want the phone, then they get the phone.
Totally. Totally. And I feel like Apple does a good job of giving people what they're looking for in their phone, especially people who, you know, have had iPhones before. Mm-hmm. They pretty much are certain that to expect a certain level of quality out of Apple's products and pretty guaranteed to get it. Like Apple does a good job delivering on that expectation.
Yeah. I think more that they've really settled into that now more so than check out all the new things that this phone can do. It is more about just like you can count on those iterative updates. And the good thing too about iPhones is that they tend to last longer, and then Apple does support older models and, you know, is always putting out updates to like improve battery life and things like that. So then you start with an iPhone 5C and you upgrade to a new device, and it does feel bigger, better, faster, stronger, and all of those other things in that one song that's escaping me right now. Stronger, better, faster.
John Astley. Daft Punk.
Thank you. Daft Punk.
That one.
That's the one, yes.
Would you be sad to lose 3D Touch if it goes away, the way rumors seem to be pointing?
So I do use 3D. It took me a while, and that's the thing. It's like it's a little bit football in front of my foot kind of deal, except instead of me being Charlie Brown mere feet away, I was like a mile away. And so I'm running at 3D Touch and I'm running at 3D Touch and I finally kicked it. And I finally kick it. I finally enjoy it. And then that's when Lucy pulls the football away from me. And of course, in this case, Lucy is Tim Cook, I guess. Yeah. And so Tim, thanks for pulling 3D Touch away from me. Yeah,
thanks
I'll be a little sad.
Thanks a lot, Tim. And thanks to you, Barry.
You too. Barry.
Barry, we've promoted you. Fire Tim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're in charge now, Barry. Those eyes could fire somebody without making them cry.
Say hello to the new CEO of Apple, Barry. All right, cool. That's how you end a show. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday, 11 a.m. Pacific, twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us. We hope that you do, tnw@twit.tv.
Now, we say that, but I haven't seen any emails. So really, if you're out there and you want to send us an email, do that, tnw@twit.tv. And maybe you'll end up in the show.
Maybe.
You can also subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNW. That's the best way to stay updated with what we're talking about. You can check in on Barry, see how he's doing. You can also, of course, follow along live. And then you can join the chat where they're always sharing new ideas for integrating bananas into the show. If you'd like, you can follow us on all of the different social media streams. That's, of course, Twitter, Instagram, etc. And if you want to tweet at me for the next job Barry should have, I'm at Micah Sargent on Twitter.
And I'm at Jason Howell. I don't know what Barry is on Twitter. We'll get back to you. Thanks to John, Jeff, John Burke, Masako, and Colleen. We had a lot of people help out on the show today, and we really do appreciate it. Thanks to you for watching Tech News Weekly. We'll see y'all next week. What are we doing?
Boom! You too, Barry.
Come on, Barry.
Come on, give me some.
Yeah. Billy.
There you are.
We love you, Barry. What is this job? Oh, Lordy.
Yeah. Welcome to Twit.
He's just, look at him.
I know.
You can't say no to that face.
No, I know. I would have a really hard time firing Barry.
And apparently he calls you out for like ageism and stuff. That's difficult.
If you say the wrong things.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So let me see.
It's not like automatic.
Barry, look, you've done a wonderful job at the company, and we appreciate you for your time here. But unfortunately,
your time has ended.
After 6 infractions, we, you know, it's just company policy. We've got to let you go.